This is DomesticPreparedness.com. Since 1998, Domestic Preparedness has been a source of solutions for the professional preparedness community. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morgan.
This podcast interview is sponsored by Bruker Deltonics, the leader in CBRN detection. For more information, visit www.bdal.com.
Domestic Preparedness is with Colonel Patrick Sharon, U.S. Army, who is the Deputy Director of the Joint Requirements Office for Chemical, Biological, Radiological, and Nuclear Defense, or CBRN Defense. The JRO supports J-8 and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and laterally the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Chemical Biological Defense. Colonel Sharon has come to this office from previously serving as the Deputy Director for Counterproliferation Policy in the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy at the Pentagon, where he served from June 2004 to December 2006. He has a long, distinguished career in the U.S. Army that includes also combat service in Operation Desert Storm, where he served as the Brigade Chemical Officer for the 1st Brigade, 3rd Armored Division. Colonel, thanks very much for taking time to have us here at your office in Crystal City.
It's my pleasure. Glad to have you.
Let's talk a little bit first about how you all relate to the state and local folks. Dom Prep, as you probably know, represents mainly the Homeland Security professionals that execute the HLS mission at the state and local levels, and it does so along with the many men and women in the National Guard, Reserves, and the Coast Guard, who are also our subscribers and readers. So having said that, I want to start with the bullet in the JRO CBRN mission statement that specifically relates to those folks, and I'm going to read it. Coordinating consequence management support for domestic civil support. Colonel, if you would you detail how you do that and what that means specifically for the state and local HLS official?
I'd be happy to. The Joint Requirements Office, as the name implies, focuses principally on chem, bio, radiological, nuclear defense activities. In that regard, we coordinate what we're calling weapons of mass destruction consequence management capabilities for domestic civil support, but beyond that, for both CONUS, or the continental United States, OCONUS, or overseas installations, military installations, and foreign consequence management support. So in the case of the Department of Defense providing military capability in response to a foreign consequence management event, we're also involved in coordinating those capabilities. Mm-hmm. That process or that coordination is done through a process called the Joint Capabilities Integration and Development System, or JCIDS process. It's a process used throughout the Joint Staff for virtually all systems that are developed by the Department of Defense, primarily to identify the needs of warfighters and what potential solutions are available across the joint community for those warfighters.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at how military forces would provide support to civil authorities in responding to a WMD event. Then we look at what those forces are currently capable of doing, identify shortfalls in meeting those solutions or that mission, and then help in the development of solutions to better meet those missions. What I think that means for state and local officials is, first, I think the DOD, are increasingly acknowledging the role we have in support of civil authorities. And again, we're very conscious of, and have been very conscious of for some time, the support role we provide. Second, I think it's clear that because the DOD has been working in this area, the CBRN defense business, the WMD defense business, for some time, that we do have some unique capabilities that we can bring to bear in support of civil authorities. And then third, what I think is really new and different is the acknowledgement that we want to improve the capabilities that we're developing so that they serve both the warfighting community that would deploy abroad and the needs of the homeland. And so I think what we've begun to acknowledge is that the homeland must be considered another part of the battlefield that the Department of Defense faces.
Mm-hmm.
So we are increasingly focused on How do we develop capabilities, and what can those capabilities bring that will serve both our forces deployed in a sort of traditional combat role and forces that would deploy in support of civil authorities here in the homeland?
Well, let's turn to a little bit about the discussion on the capabilities that you can bring to bear in W&D consequence management. Can you tell us a little bit about what they are?
Well, again, the JRO itself is really a staff organization that's intended to use the process that exists to bring the needs of the warfighter community into the hands of those people that develop capabilities. So in the case of the JRO really bringing assets or capabilities to bear, we are more in the business of enabling mm-hmm. The development of capabilities. But in the consequence management, WMD consequence management business specifically, we are involved in identifying and improving capabilities across a wide range of WMD-related missions. And not only material capabilities, but what we call non-material capabilities, doctrines, exercises, forces, and the identification of forces, improvement of forces, leader development activities, and a wide variety of other activities go well beyond what I would consider the traditional development of material solutions.
Mm-hmm.
This is, again, to use the joint staff vernacular, is what we call DOTMIL-PF, which is an acronym that stands for Doctrine, Organization, Training, Leader Development, Materiel, and Forces. Correction, Facilities. Mm-hmm. So it's an acronym we use that keeps in mind the whole breadth of activities mm-hmm. that are necessary to field really a complete solution to a problem. Again, not surprisingly, the strategy here is it's easier to develop a doctrine and field it to a force and teach that force how to use it than it is necessarily to spend the kind of money and the kind of time to build a particular device or field a group of devices or technologies. So we look for ways to optimize the resources that the department has mm-hmm. To best serve the interests of the warfighters, whether they serve at home or abroad.
Well, in the area of homeland defense, you provide support to NORTHCOM. Can you tell us what you do here and what that would mean, say, for the CSTs?
Well, as you know, NORTHCOM's a fairly new command by Goldwater-Nichols kind of terms. So our relationship with NORTHCOM is also fairly new. Having said that, we've been working very closely with them in the last approximately year to help them identify those kinds of needs that homeland forces or DOD forces that would participate in the homeland support, what they really need. And one of the things that we've really tried to work hard on is the idea of institutionalizing a little better the WMD CSTs. And when I mean institutionalizing, I mean trying to normalize the modernization and sustainment of the equipment for the CSTs over the long haul. The idea being if we can develop a program that actually is looking out for the future of the CSTs, modernizing their equipment, sustaining their equipment, and really kind of normalizing the kind of equipment they're using, then we've got a better chance of being able to use the dollars available to the best effect we can achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And so a couple of specific examples I think would serve well in this area is, the two what I would consider major programs that we're kind of talking with the CST about, or CSTs about, in the National Guard Bureau specifically. One's called the Unified Command Suite. The second is called Analytical Lab System. The Unified Command Suite, as the name implies, is basically a high-end, highly technical communications and command and control system. The Analytical Lab System, again, is a system that's intended to provide analytical laboratory support right at the point where the CSTs are operating.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those are really key capabilities that the CSTs have, and they're faced with some challenges in terms of maintaining and sustaining and modernizing both of those capabilities. Mm-hmm. One of the things the JRO has taken on responsibility for is helping the WMD CSTs and the National Guard Bureau with that modernization and sustainment effort, so that those two key capabilities are able to be sustained over time, and that the resources are available to sustain those. Dollars and cents is really what we're talking about.
And now, just for clarification, the analytical lab system would enable the CSTs to do the on-site characterization for determining what the agent is. And
that's correct. In
modeling and that sort of thing.
Primarily, the analytical lab system is the characterization of the mm-hmm. agent that's captured right at the point. So if the WMD CSTs bring a sample to the analytical lab can do an on-site analysis of what that sample is or is not. It gives you a much more real-time capability where the CSTs are to be able to give you early sense of what might be present in the atmosphere, what might be present at the attack site, and begin to take sort of risk mitigation steps right there at the point. And the analytical lab system is a system that's already in the hands of the CSTs, mm-hmm. as is the unified command suite. Our concern is several of those in the early stages of the CSTs are coming up on a it's time to modernize mm-hmm. point, mm-hmm. And the worry is that as opposed to a convergence of capabilities across the CSTs, that the CSTs begin to diverge, and so each CST has a remarkably different capability instead of a similar capability.
Mm-hmm.
And if you imagine the CSTs might potentially serve outside of their assigned state in some mm-hmm. Major catastrophe, you would want some consistency across those CSTs in terms of their capability mm-hmm. to analyze mm-hmm. samples, their capability in the case of the Unified Command Suite, their capability to communicate with each other, with local, state, federal law enforcement, as well as local, mm-hmm. state, federal communications, emergency management communication systems, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we should go back. After all, the R in JRO is requirements. So having said that, the state and local folks have resources like the selected equipment list, the CEL, and the approved equipment list, or the AEL, and MIPT, the Memorial Institute for Prevention of Terrorism's Resource Knowledge Base. Can you tell us what your role is in generating or defining requirements as may have application for the first responders, who obviously rely on those lists to help them make the procurement decisions and so forth?
Sure. The primarily and historically, the Joint Requirements Office has been about what I would consider traditional warfighter requirements in the CBRN defense business. Now, that traditionally or historically only goes back 4 or 5 years. And up to this point, or up until just recently, that was our niche. In the last year or 18 months, it's become apparent that the battlefield has expanded. Mm-hmm. And our ability to look at requirements exclusively for forward deployed forces has told us that we need to look more broadly at homeland defense requirements. The way we go about doing that, even though we are called the Joint Requirements Office, is really about capabilities and identifying capability needs. To return to this idea of the JSIDS process that I described before, the first step in that process is what's called a capabilities-based assessment, or CBA. Mm-hmm. And that assessment really starts out with identifying what the mission is that needs to be performed, and then kind of conducting an analysis of the functional area. So looking at what the strategy is, and then linking the strategy to individual tasks. Mm-hmm. And then looking at those individual tasks and asking ourselves what capabilities currently exist that can accomplish those tasks, and what capabilities don't exist or exist in inadequate numbers or inadequate in terms of the capability itself. For example, a detector that can't detect everything it needs to. And then finally, at the conclusion, at the sort of tail end of this capabilities-based assessment, we take a look at, well, what are some functional solutions? And so the solutions that we identify, I would describe as our version of something like the selected equipment list or the approved equipment list.
Mm-hmm.
That whole list of desired and required capabilities then becomes the work plan for the rest of the joint CAMBIO defense community. That is the Defense Threat Reduction Agency and its role as the Joint Science mm-hmm. and Technology Office, and the Joint Program Executive Officer, Major General Reeves, and his organization's responsibility to research, develop, and field CAMBIO defenses to the forces.
Mm-hmm.
So we sort of set the agenda for what it is the warfighters need, the warfighters being services, the combatant commanders, what it is that they need, and then what is it that we can deliver to them through technology or through other means, like I said, whether it's doctrine, training, other mm-hmm. capabilities. Mm-hmm. We have then is sort of our analog to these other lists, what we call the joint priority list of CBRN capabilities or CBRN defense capabilities. That list is developed in a combined effort by the uniformed services, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and the combatant commanders, the regional combatant commanders and the functional combatant commanders, such as Strategic Command or Transportation Command, functional commanders.
Mm-hmm.
Those combined efforts then reflect what is a prioritized list of capabilities that the joint force has established that begins or reinforces the process of developing material solutions that General Reeves and his organization then go after. So a way of describing our list is, on our list you will see something described as individual protection or respiratory protection. That's the description of the capability.
Mm-hmm.
Then the material solution for respiratory protection would be a protective mask.
Yeah.
One material solution. There may be others as well, but that's kind of how we relate to the process. Ours is less about describing the specific equipment mm-hmm. and more about describing the capability that is needed, and let the material developers develop that piece of equipment or those varieties of pieces of equipment in order to solve that problem for mm-hmm. us.
And you've got input seat at the table with the Coast Guard, so therefore that requirement for the Coast Guard feeds back into their acquisition process.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. And in the sense that the Coast Guard has requirements that are similar to the more traditional services,
mm-hmm.
We develop a joint force kind of approach. So mm-hmm. the Coast Guard may say we have a particular respiratory protection requirement, very similar to what the Army or the Navy has,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and they have a seat at the table to say, you know, that we want the same capability, or that's a very high priority capability in some cases.
Yeah, in PPE, actually, their requirement has more similarity to yours than the first responders because they're in a maritime environment.
Correct.
You know. Now, when the JRO does its experimentation, do you ever have input from the first responder community?
The short answer is yes. Our role in the experimentation process is a fairly emerging one. As we have begun to establish a more mature relationship with Joint Forces Command, who is the lead combatant commander for experimentation efforts across the department, we have established a relationship with them to pursue experimentation efforts related to WMD and WMD activities. Among many of those experimentation efforts are at least a couple that are discreetly focused on weapons of mass destruction consequence management activities. In that regard, then, we've talked to the National Guard Bureau and NORTHCOM and sought their inputs into how we can pursue particular areas of experimentation that would benefit those two organizations as part of the entire national response to an event here in the homeland.
Let's go back to something you said about characterization with the analytical support system, the lab system. I know that, you all are very much involved in working the issues of fusion of information as it relates to a CBRN attack, and that you see that as sort of a tripartite issue of characterization, modeling, and simulation. Let's talk a little bit about what you all are doing in the work of characterization of a CBRN hazard. Tell us a little bit about that, leading into prediction and modeling and simulation.
Absolutely. Well, in the area of characterization, we have begun pursuing technologies and capabilities that take us beyond what you might describe as the traditional battlefield detector business. So in the old days, a battlefield detector basically told you that you had nerve agent or you had blister agent and kind of left you at that. What I would describe as a binary yes or no problem, and you took actions on the battlefield to deal with what that sensor told you. As we move forward with technical capabilities, we're beginning to be able to put on the battlefield the kind of technical capabilities that will do more than that, that can actually characterize the agent. For example, mass spectrometry. Is going to be in a reconnaissance vehicle in the near future that will be on the battlefield. So that reconnaissance vehicle will give us more than just a detection of an agent. It will be able to characterize that agent with the accuracy associated with that kind of technology. Part of that then is not just a characterization at the point where it's identified, but an automation of that information sent through a warning and reporting network so that as soon as that particular hazard is identified and characterized, the entire battlefield that's part of a communications architecture, communications network, will get the warning of that that detection and characterization. Associated with that, then, is the necessary modeling and simulation and predictive analysis kind of tools that will take that information, take other information about weather, terrain, intelligence reporting, medical reporting, and be able to do the kind of information fusion that goes beyond just a notice of an event, but provides some prediction of downwind hazard, for example, health effects of forces within the downwind hazard, potential casualty models, and a wide variety of other modeling and simulation kinds of efforts that this kind of data fusion gives us. So what we're really after here is more than just the individual point detector providing a more sophisticated point detection capability. What we're really after is the integration of all those sensors all over the battlefield, whatever that battlefield happens to be, with all the other kinds of information that's present and part of the data floating around in everybody's networks. And then the fusion of that information, one, to give commanders and decision makers the ability to make choices and better informed choices about what to do next. And two, the kind of predictive tools that say, here's what the possible outcomes of this particular event might be, and here are the kinds of risk mitigation measures you, the decision maker, can probably take now in order to deal with that problem. And you can imagine in the case of a biological warfare or a large-scale outbreak, that kind of information fusion would really provide decision makers, whether they be commanders or the medical community or local civil authorities, the ability to make some better informed, more rapid decisions that might include taking medical therapeutics kinds of measures much earlier in the process than we have in the past. So that's our goal, is this vision of the ability to fuse all the different data elements and provide that kind of fusion in a much more robust and timely way on behalf of the warfighting commander's decision making.
That also has great potential for after action reports and for also training purposes. Correct.
That's correct. One of the things that we've really gone after there really is two main programs that we're interested in right now that give us both the ability to do this modeling after the fact, but also the ability to do some deliberate planning and some exercise simulation capabilities. One's called the Joint Effects Model, and that's really a standardized predictive and tracking capability. Goes beyond traditional CBRN hazards and includes industrial hazards, so it gives the more traditional warfighter in a more traditional battlefield this predictive capability, but it also provides for a much less traditional or non-traditional modern-day kind of industrial hazard problem. The second program that really links in with the Joint Effects Model is what's called the Joint Operational Effects Federation. And that really is a modeling and simulation tool intended to support deliberate planning as well as risk assessment and risk mitigation measures prior to an operation. Those two together will provide the ability to do what-if drills and the ability to exercise and train staffs and decision-makers, because you'll be able to input events artificially into those systems and create scenarios that provide the kind of outcomes that you cannot get anywhere else. Mm-hmm. It's impossible, really, in this day and age, to be able to go on some large-scale training event and model the kinds of releases and the kinds of problems that CBRN events create.
Mm-hmm.
You can't model that on some training field exercise. It's really, really difficult, if not impossible. This fills that void for us.
And does that mean, actually, that you're also working the JWARN as well?
JWARN, that's correct. JWARN really is the mechanism or the software that really links the sensors to the network, and that will be the that's the part of the fusion that happens at the point where the sensor detects something and does that kind of analysis that we want to achieve with some of the new detection capabilities we're going after.
Well, let's move into a little more discussion on the sensors. That certainly is the area where you're engaged. Can you tell us a little bit about your sensor applications here? You talked about the mass spec sensors for the reconnaissance vehicles. Any others that you want to ping for us?
Well, there's you know, this is really an area where there's a lot going on. The biological warfare detection business has been since the Gulf War of 1990-91 a growth industry and continues to be so. You're probably aware that we've got the vehicle-mounted biological identification detection system, what we call the BIDS. You know, that's really kind of our first generation, and it's already begun to be replaced with the Joint Bio Point Detection System, or JBPDS. That's an upgrade in both capacity and capability, and so it's able to more quickly identify a biological warfare agent than its predecessor, and has a larger library of agents it can identify. We continue to want to improve on that capability. Not surprisingly, our goal in the biodetection business is to get beyond where we currently are, which has typically been described as detect to treat. In other words, detect in enough time that we can take medical treatment measures on those people that have been exposed by a cloud passing over in the last 15 mm-hmm. or 20 minutes. Two, really a detect-to-warn capability like we have with chemical warfare agents and some of the industrial compounds. So, you know, our goal really is to get to the point where when a bio-warfare event occurs, we have near real-time detection and identification, and that's all part of a system that warns those in the downwind hazard area. So we minimize the number of people that could be potentially exposed to the biological warfare agent, whatever it happens to be. So that's a big one, and we're looking at, in terms of capabilities that we desire across the CBRN spectrum, not just point detectors, which has kind of been our traditional approach, but standoff detectors, detectors that can at a distance see a cloud, an event, a contaminant on the ground, and provide with some accuracy a readout of what that contaminant might be, mm-hmm. and its characteristics. That's been a real challenge. The standoff detection problem is a real technical mm-hmm. challenge for the technical community. But because it's a technical challenge, doesn't necessarily take it off the list of things that we really think we need. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of, I think, technical approaches to solve that. From a representing the warfighter perspective, the need for standoff detection remains very high on the list of capabilities that we desire. The other thing that I think is very promising, and it's from a Homeland Security perspective promising, is an acknowledgement in the last 4 or 5 years on behalf of the DOD that these detectors, whatever they are, need to also be able to detect toxic industrial chemicals mm-hmm. and toxic industrial materials. And I would attribute that to our experiences in Bosnia and Kosovo. We discovered that, and it probably should have been no surprise, but we discovered that on future battlefields, complex terrain, mm-hmm. industrial, urban areas, that the battlefield hazards presented by toxic industrial materials and toxic industrial chemicals are probably greater mm-hmm. In many cases than the hazards that would be presented by a traditional chem bio kind of agent.
I mean, intentional or otherwise.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And so we've acknowledged that there exists a large industrial hazard out there on future military operations, and that industrial hazard may or may not be the result of an enemy's release. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, it may not matter. I mean, if what we're about is protecting the force, then how that particular hazard was released, while it's important mm-hmm. to know the defensive measures necessary are necessary regardless of the desired intent of a mm-hmm. bad guy or an accident, and that I bring that up because that's becoming now increasingly an acknowledgement that we share a very, very similar problem with first responders indeed. And those responsible with the homeland security.
Let's talk a little bit about radiological incident response. You're active in shielding. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, the things we're doing in radiological are really, unfortunately, I think, lagging a little behind some of the more the chemical and biological efforts. That has been an area where our focus for many, many years was the nuclear warfare on the battlefield of battlefields of some distant land, Western Europe, and so we built a lot of capability towards that end. We have only recently acknowledged that we need to be much more sensitive to the wider variety of radiological problems that we face beyond the more traditional sort of nuclear warfare problems. And we've begun really pursuing a new agenda for radiological hazards that ranges across, like many of our other efforts, it ranges across protection to detection, to examination of decontamination capabilities, and to include medical measures, whether they be therapeutic or prophylaxis. Mm-hmm. So I would describe it as a renewed emphasis on our defenses against radiological hazards. And in some ways, I would suspect the Department of Defense is lagging a little behind the civilian community in regards to that. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the technologies, but the acknowledgement of the treatment of those hazards. We're making good progress, so my estimation is that this is an area that we have neglected for a while, but in the last few years has really caught on and I think is getting the treatment it deserves.
You mentioned protection. I've seen another term that the JRO uses, collective protection. What's happening in this area? And tell us a little bit about how you define that.
Sure. Collective protection really, from our perspective, is that kind of protection where we are able to provide a citadel or a space where a number of people can be protected. So it's the idea of a shelter. Mm-hmm. Our emphasis until recently was primarily on deployable mobile kinds of collective protection, collective protection that might be able to be put on a truck, deployed to a theater, dropped off the truck and set up rather quickly. And much of that collective protection was focused primarily on deployable hospitals, for example, command and control facilities that could be set up and provide a relatively clean shirt sleeve environment for those people that were working inside. The other part about the collective protection business that we have made some investments in and continue, I think, to do so is collective protected areas aboard ships. And the Navy has kind of transformed their thinking about what areas need to be protected and what ships need to be protected. And I think they've begun, and I think with a lot of support from a number of areas, to take a look at changing their philosophy about which ships and what areas of ships need to be protected, primarily with this idea that those areas that probably need to be protected are those areas on those ships that are going to be operating most closely in the littoral area in the near the shoreline.
Mm-hmm. Decontamination, you're active in that area as well.
Absolutely. It's one of the areas that we're really, I think, working hard on, a broad range of things. Questions in terms of how we decontaminate sensitive equipment, whether they be radios or other sensitive pieces of equipment. The area of decontaminating casualties and decontaminating human remains has been an area that's it's been a challenge for the department, really, and we're working hard on that, making some investments. And probably not the least important is an area that's been an area of concern for some time, and that is decontaminating solutions that are significantly less hazardous, less caustic, and more environmentally friendly, and require much less water to use. So it is, you know, our current technologies or sort of the technologies of the past have been required a lot of water. The solutions that have been used are caustic and oftentimes would destroy the materials they were applied to as quickly as they destroyed the agent that they were applied to, particularly in materials that might be sensitive to caustics, rubbers, gaskets, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, we're not exactly environmentally friendly. So this is a good area, again, of convergence between Department of Defense and the folks defending the homeland in the sense that I think, you know, we're all moving towards a desired capability that meets those kinds of characteristics I described. Particularly the characteristics of environmentally friendly.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're acknowledging that we do not want to leave a mess behind.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that's similar to Environmental Protection Agency kind of desires.
Lastly, in these the laundry list we got here, reconstitution. Now, is this a product or a process area for you?
Really, a process area, and it's sort of the ultimate version of decontamination in the sense that Reconstitution for us means bringing a particular item all the way back to full use. That's a real challenge. Our philosophy in cleaning up military equipment up to this point has been focused on being able to quickly restore it to operational capability so it could go right back in the fight. Reconstitution is really about once the fight's over, what can you do to limit or minimize the residual hazard that may still be present to the point where it can be operated safely or with the least amount of hazard possible.
Now, a quick question on acquisition. The acquisition strategy for state and local authorities is always a challenge with the DHS grant systems. What support, if any, can you and the JRO provide there?
I think we can provide some insights into what the Department of Defense is pursuing in terms of capabilities and technologies. The DHS grant system and the DOD resource planning, programming, budgeting system, I suspect are far apart in terms of their philosophies. As you know, we the DOD really are planning in increments of 2 to 5 years, and so we have kind of the president's budget and insights into the next year, and then are sort of planning a bit more strategically into the 5 to 6 year time frame. It doesn't mean that we don't change priorities, but it does mean that we're a bit more deliberate, I think, about how those priorities change and under what set of conditions. Having said that, and my knowledge of the DHS grant system is limited, I admit, but I think we could provide some insights into what the DOD is actually working on in terms of technical solutions that would help the state and local authorities determine whether they needed to pursue through a DHS grant the same capability, or whether there's an opportunity for the two communities to come together after on a particular capability or technical solution.
Mm-hmm. In the last section, I want to turn to the medical NBC defense requirements. You folks at JRO coordinate those. I've seen two particular medical areas where you play a role. First, let's talk about medical diagnostics. What are you doing here?
Well, we've got really one big program that I wanted to talk about, and it's called the Joint Biological Agent Identification System, or JBAIDS. That's a program where we have worked very closely with the medical community to develop what is essentially a portable kit that can do diagnostic work with specimens very early in the process. In other words, it can go to where the problem is and provide very early on the kind of analytical and diagnostic capability that heretofore has been present only in laboratories further away from the attack area or the area where a particular event has occurred.
And what about medical therapeutics?
Well, the medical therapeutics is a big area. There's a lot going on in terms of investments on behalf of the department. It's probably best captured in a program that the department has been calling the Transformational Medical Technology Initiative, or TMTI, which is really largely a change in philosophy on behalf of the department about how to develop medical responses to future primarily biological warfare threats. It's intended to take a broader approach, an approach that takes on categories of hazards or categories of agents versus individual agents. It is at this point focused on therapeutics. There's been some desire to, and not surprisingly, to get ahead of the problem by also looking at pretreatments, prophylaxis. This is a fairly new project, probably a year, 18 months old. The most promising efforts within this TMTI are focused on therapeutics, but it's a very interesting program. I will admit that I am not sophisticated enough in my understanding of all the details of it to be able to provide you the specifics of the mechanics of it. That's a program that's currently being run at both the Defense Threat Reduction Agency as our sort of science and technology venue, and the program management itself out of the Office of the Secretary of Defense. But very intriguing, very mm-hmm. promising kinds of technologies and science that I think are gonna show some real benefits here in the near future. The other thing is, and I think one of the areas where I think the therapeutics is a kind of an area of convergence between DOD and Homeland Security folks, or even the local and first responder folks, is our combined effort and our participation with the Department of Homeland Security in both BioShield, which, as you know, is really sort of medical countermeasures emphasis, and the Strategic National Stockpile effort, which we're making a contribution towards, the department is, in terms of anthrax vaccine at this point. So that's a real collaboration between the Department of Defense and the Department of Homeland Security that I think does have a direct benefit to the state, local, and first responder community. Mm-hmm.
JRO coordinates with non-DOD labs on science and technology, and I guess this would be the Department of Energy National Labs and the Health and Human Services Labs. Is that correct?
That is correct. Mm-hmm. That is correct. We, as I described before, our primary, the department's primary science and technology focal point or venue for this area resides at the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, and we work closely with DOE labs, the national labs, the DHS and HHS laboratories and research facilities. And there's a expanding and improving and maturing relationship with academia and commercial enterprises. And so I think, there's an area where some real promise lies outside of what I would describe as the traditional science and technology venues that we've leveraged in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not surprisingly, DOD is really benefiting from the expanded interest in the civilian community in developing defenses on behalf of first responders and the local and state governments.
Mm-hmm.
So the commercial enterprises and academia are moving in that direction, are interested in supporting the local and state authorities, and as a result, DOD is learning, benefiting, and collaborating with all those organizations.
Yeah, this is interesting. This is what we found with NIH, the same kind of thrust into academia and commercial labs. One last question for you, Colonel. You have a training program for CBRN familiarization. Is this something or something like it that would be available to the civilian first responders?
Well, our training program is varied, ranging from a kind of web-based familiarization course, which I think is maybe what you're referring to,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really intended for the novice. And then ranging all the way out to support that we provide to a wide range of both individual and collective training opportunities. The place where I think the real interesting work going on right now and in the future is out at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, at the U.S. Army Maneuver Support Center. The WMD CST courses are being taught out there now. There's a wide variety of individual courses as well. So a first responder could attend a course out there that's taught by the Department of Defense, but really is in many cases open to all mm-hmm. comers. And then the really exciting news right now is that they are building and will probably have operational in the next year or 18 months what they're calling a first responder training facility. It is a from the ground up, designed in collaboration with the first responder community, the WMDCSTs, and the Department of Defense, a facility where they've got essentially a training range to do both individual and collective kinds of training activities right there at Fort Leonard Wood.
Wow.
It includes bunkers and cave complexes. It includes confined space. It includes what appears to be warehouses, laboratories. Mm-hmm. And it's really designed so that they'll be able to, as a small team, or a team the size of a WMDCST,
mm-hmm.
in an outdoor environment with the rain falling or the sun shining or the snow falling, be able to go through a series of rehearsals and training exercises on as realistic a training environment mm-hmm. as can be provided to them. So it's really exciting. The other thing, of course, that goes on out there is they have the ability to do some indoor training with chemical warfare agents that they've had for a number of years out there that, if I'm not mistaken, WMDCSTs and some of the first responder community have an opportunity to train in that environment too. So in an enclosed environment, they're also able to interact with actual chemical warfare agent. So a very exciting kind of nexus of training opportunities out there.
Would that also include, in addition to chem, bio and rad?
The indoor facility, if it hasn't been approved for bio and rad, is very close to being approved.
Mm-hmm.
They won't be using they'll be using BG, which is an anthrax equivalent, but not toxic. So it's mm-hmm. a sort of non-toxic version. But BG is a simulant. Causes certain kinds of reactions to occur in some of the detectors. So they hope to use BG in that indoor facility, mm-hmm. and they are also pursuing the ability to use radiological sources in that facility, so they'll be able to go beyond the chemical and do C, B, and R mm-hmm. kinds of detection capabilities. So,
and that's the facility's not mature yet, or is it?
Well, the facility's actually been there for some time. The facility, mm-hmm. What's called the CDTF, the Chem Defense Training Facility, has been there for some time.
Colonel, just to clarify, you say that the facility at Fort Leonard Wood is operational, but it's expanding. What are the names of the facilities, or if it's all in one?
The one facility that has the indoor actual chemical agent use, chemical agent training, is called the Chemical Defense Training Facility, CDTF. The new facility... The first responder facility is called the Terry Facility, and it's named after a Chemical Corps soldier
mm-hmm.
in memoriam. So the Terry Facility will be the new facility. The older facility that's really been in existence since the late 90s is the CDTF.
Mm-hmm. Well, Colonel, I really appreciate your time and the time you've taken to talk with us, and I want to thank you very much, and thank you as well for your service to our country.
Well, thank you. Enjoyed spending time together.
This has been a Domestic Preparedness podcast interview. Thank you for listening.